take your time, take it up there with you if you like.
Thank you.
Sir, you have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes.
Okay. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Timothy Barbro. I'm here on behalf of Anthony Goodman. The issue in this case, I think the issue is whether the trial court erred, abused its discretion in not permitting Mr. Goodman to withdraw his plea of guilty, entered Alford pleas to 3 charges. And I think there's a sort of a preliminary issue, if you will, is whether or not the waiver, the expressed waiver contained in the plea agreement of his right to withdraw his appeal ends the issue. So I think there's essentially 2 issues.
Well, I think more than that, actually. But
well, there probably is. There's
the plea was entered, and there's no issue, it seems to me, that it wasn't entered voluntarily and intelligently. He wants to withdraw it because he asserts he has a defense now, essentially, as I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, but I think
But my point is, though, if it was entered knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, then it meets constitutional muster. Beyond that, we've got case law that said this was a plea agreement, and the Commonwealth honored its side, and certain charges were dropped, certain recommendations were made. So we have the jurisprudence from our Supreme Court and this court that notes that while the ability to withdraw a plea is controlled by statute, the fact that there's a plea agreement, a contract, if you will, that and the Commonwealth has performed its part of that contract, that militates against withdrawal. So we've got that. And then we have the express waiver on top of that. So, I mean, it seems to me that you've got a lot of jurisprudence to get around here for us to get to the point you want us to get to when we start from the premise that there's no issue with a knowing, voluntary, and intelligently entered into guilty plea.
Well, and I think I think you're exactly right, but I think I'd take exception with the premise. I think that there is evidence that the plea was not voluntarily, knowingly, intelligently made with a full understanding of the consequences of entering that plea. And I do think that's the sort of the crux of the matter. Because
so what do you have to support that?
Well, with regard to that, I think there's issues with regard to the voluntariness of the plea. You have his allegations or his statements that were made perhaps a week after the plea was entered that he was pressured into taking the plea by his counsel.
Did the court engage in a colloquy with him concerning that precise issue, whether he was pleading guilty freely and voluntarily?
He did. They did. The court did. And again, I think with regard to the second issue about whether he should be able to withdraw the plea, the court's been clear that reliance on that plea colloquy is misplaced in deciding whether he should be allowed to withdraw the plea or not. But now I think we got to go back in time, and is the plea colloquy, now we're looking at whether that plea was in fact voluntarily entered.
Well,
so
you beat me to it. I was just going to follow up on her question, which is simply in that colloquy, mm-hmm. the trial court said, you understand you can get up 5 to life, which is exactly what he could get. I mean, that's what the statute provides. And that the firearm charge carries a 3-year mandatory sentence. He answered in the affirmative that he understood the charges against him. He answered in the affirmative that he had time to discuss the charges and possible offenses with defenses with his attorney. And he answered in the affirmative that he was entering the pleas freely and voluntarily. He also affirmatively denied that anyone forced or threatened him to enter the guilty pleas and that he understood he was entering the pleas without any recommendation as to sentencing. I mean, I don't know how it gets any more voluntary and intelligent than that if the record reflects that, which I think is Judge O'Brien's point.
Well, the record also reflects that you have Goodman and at least one other witness saying that his attorney had told him, had advised him, that essentially there was a 3 to 10 year sentence that he wouldn't be sentenced to any less than 3 nor more than 10. And, you know, that didn't come up in the plea colloquy, but it came up within a matter of days after the plea had been accepted by the court.
I don't think the court found that to be credible, though.
Well, the court, there's no, first of all, there's no evidence to rebut that. There's no testimony. There's no affidavit from Goodman's attorney saying, I didn't do that. All that the record contains is the trial court's statement that I can't believe that your attorney would say something like that. But that was said by the trial court without any evidence whatsoever to support it. And so you have Goodman who feels, and you have to step back and, you know, and you know, he goes in that morning prepared to go to trial. In fact, they even begin the process. He enters a plea of not guilty. And then this plea is sort of is thrust upon him at that moment. And he has about, he has less than an hour to contemplate the plea. And, you know, you've got all this pressure. He's facing first-degree murder charges. And he's got all this pressure, and he and his attorney go out, and they have this discussion. And Goodman comes away with that, with an understanding that there's a limitation on his exposure. Now, that, you know, and again...
Well, that's inconsistent with what the judge told him, though.
That's...
Judge Humphreys pointed out the colloquy. He was aware of the exposure that he had.
He's aware of the exposure he's in that colloquy. I you know, in his letter a few days later, he talks about, you know, seeing it in the Freelance Star that he was up to, subject to a life in prison, and that's the first time he really understood that. There's also information in there that talks about what the maximum is in Maryland versus Virginia, and there was some confusion there. I'm just saying that when you have these real-time situations going on, and you're in a room and you're having these discussions that are going to affect you for the rest of your life,
we see these, we call them buyer's remorse cases. People plead guilty and then they suddenly, you know, decide for whatever reason that it was a mistake and they want to undo it. And the law is pretty clear that that's not easy to do. You're required to jump through a lot of hoops. And here, in particular, because the Commonwealth relied upon his plea, they dropped some charges. I mean, you know, it's not just a question of withdrawing a straight-up plea, which the statute controls. This is a contractual arrangement. And he's bargained away certain rights that he's got, as, you know, and he doesn't have many when you plead guilty, but he bargained away probably the most important one that he does have when he pleads guilty, which is the right to an appeal. And, you know, if he knew what he was getting into, and the record, as Judge Decker and Judge O'Brien have pointed out, seemed to support that, then you can do that. I mean, your constitutional rights are waivable, and that's what he's done.
Well, and it's, you know, it's a trend that I've seen over my practice, which is that these plea agreements are becoming more and more loaded up with these waivers of everything.
You don't have to, you know, you can always put the Commonwealth to the test of its evidence.
Well, and I think he wanted to. And he came in there ready to plead not guilty.
He should have done that before he entered into the plea agreement.
Well, you know, these are not parties that are in equal bargaining positions either. I mean, these are really contracts of adhesion is what they are. I mean, you've got, you know, we'll drop a first-degree murder charge only if you surrender your right to appeal or to withdraw your guilty plea. I mean, that's not really a fair bargain, if you will, and you see that. And again, I mean, at what point, you know, is it going to stop? At what point do we say that the Commonwealth, and I know there's a case on, you know, there's a case on point that says that's upheld this particular waiver. But again, you know, you talk about buyer's remorse. You know, Goodman, this is not somebody who sat back and waited until he got sentenced and then complained or anything of that nature. We're talking about someone who wrote to the court, you know, in less than almost a week, I think it was 8 days later, wrote to the court, said, I didn't understand this. My attorney told me this. I have a reasonable defense, and I think he does. And, you know, and I should be allowed to withdraw my plea of guilty. And I didn't, and if what he says is true, then he really didn't understand. It wasn't a voluntary, knowing, intelligently guilty plea, regardless of that plea colloquy. I mean, if that plea colloquy is the end of the story, then I'm done.
That's why it's there. The trial court needs to make sure, and by the way, they're also making a record for us, so we can make sure that the defendant knows what he's getting into. That's the best example we have of the defendant being aware of all of these things they're giving up when they enter a plea of guilty.
Well, and you have this—you have the defendant saying, you know, my counsel told me I can't, you know, don't say anything. You know, and specifically with regard to the issue about the waiver of his right to, the waiver of his right to withdraw his guilty plea. The judge asked him in that same colloquy, do you understand you're giving up this right? And his response was, I guess so. That's not a very, you know, authoritative waiver. I guess so. She specifically asked him, and that's what he said. I don't think that evidences a, you know, a knowing and intelligent waiver of that right. I guess so. That was his quote. And so if you get past that, and I've only got a few minutes left, just briefly, I mean, I think he's met the requirements to withdraw his plea of guilty. I think it was made in good faith. I think the timing of it is the best evidence that it was made in good faith. You know, he has a reasonable defense. This is a case where he proffered, there was testimony at a hearing from witnesses who said that this is, and I know the court's read it, but it involves the a robbery and murder involved in a drug deal. And there were two people, he and a co-defendant, who were charged with a crime. And the surviving victim is alleged to have told a jailhouse, someone he was in the jail with, who testified that essentially my client wasn't involved in it and didn't do the shooting and didn't do the robbery. And that was somewhat confirmed by the testimony of his girlfriend who was present at the scene, Shanks, his then girlfriend, who testified that she didn't see him with the gun, and then he was back in the car when the shots occurred. So he has a reasonable defense. There's no prejudice to the Commonwealth.
Well, I was going to ask about that because the court found there was prejudice to the Commonwealth because the Commonwealth witnesses in the case had already been sentenced on their own charges, so they were, you know, nothing hanging over them to cooperate any further. And they were already serving their sentences in the penitentiary. It seems to me that's pretty classic prejudice.
Well, I you know, the witnesses, you know, first you've got, I mean, you know, I don't know how that applies to Gaines, who's the alleged victim, who is the victim in the case. I don't know how the fact that he's been sentenced, I don't know anything about him being sentenced or being charged with a crime, but I don't think that rationale applies to him. And Shanks, his girlfriend. So I'm not sure
where. Is it a factual finding or a legal finding, prejudice to the Commonwealth?
The issue of whether there's prejudice to the Commonwealth, I believe, is a. I think it is a factual finding, but I think it's something that there's no evidence in the record to support that factual finding in this case. I don't think any of the witnesses that I'm aware of, Gaines or Shanks, that there's anything about them being sentenced that would have caused prejudice. The way I read that was they're incarcerated now. It's going to make it difficult to get these witnesses back here.
You didn't read it that they have no motivation to testify?
Not the victim in the case who is Gaines. That's the only other witness there is, Gaines and Shanks, and they decided not to use Shanks. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon. Darren. Again, Your Honors, Leah Darren for the Commonwealth. Our position is this case presents no new ground for this court to plow. If the court looks at its decision in Griffin, which has to do with the waiver argument, or the court looks to Pritchett and Ramsey and Williams, where this court has repeatedly looked at a straight-up withdrawal of an Alford guilty plea. In all of these cases, those four cases, if you look at just those four cases, much less the many other cases where this court has considered the withdrawal of a guilty plea, this case presents no new ground. If I hear other counsel's argument correctly, he tends to focus, I think, on the fact that the defendant changed his mind rather rapidly after he pled guilty. And I'd submit that, and the argument that he really didn't have enough time to really think this through. And I just submit that the trial court The trial court rejects that in its findings of the fact that the defendant's prior actions in this case, prior to previous counsel to current counsel, the defendant's actions with regard to his first attorney. And I think the record also supports the trial court's statements at the time it makes its determination that the guilty plea is not going to be withdrawn. And if you look at the appendix, at the record, also the defendant's the evidence that came in again at the sentencing phase of at the sentencing hearing on May 25th of 2016, where the court made its second finding that the guilty plea would not be withdrawn. There's additional evidence of the fact that this defendant had been offered, and some of those statements actually come out in allocution, during the defendant's allocution, about that he had been offered a previous sentence, that he, at the time that Shanks and Clinton had been offered their plea agreements, which he had rejected. So the trial, all of this, going back around, supports the trial court's conclusion that this was not some last minute thrown on him, didn't have a chance to really think it through.
Well, it was last minute, though.
Well,
I mean, the record reflects that it
we submit
came
that,
up at the last
that
minute.
The case was certainly, the record shows that this case was headed for a jury trial on the defendant's request, and that he changed his mind once again at the last minute to plead guilty. So this last minute, and that seems to be the thrust of the defendant's argument, that this is in keeping with the defendant's way of going. So we submit that, again, that aside, and even including that, this case presents no new ground for this court to plow. Turning to the express waiver in the guilty plea itself, that plea agreement could not be clearer. It's a whopping two-page plea agreement that the defendant told the court that he signed. The plea agreement itself indicates that he was knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily waiving his right to withdraw the guilty plea and his right to appeal. That's at page 62 of the appendix. The colloquy itself shows that the defendant told the court that he had had sufficient time to talk to his attorney, that he confirmed that his pleas were freely and voluntarily entered, that he was entirely satisfied with the services of his attorney, and that that there was nothing that his attorney had failed to do that he wanted him to do. And he repeatedly indicated, not only during the not guilty plea colloquy, but again during the guilty plea colloquy, which followed the hour-long recess that the court allowed the defendant to take and to consult with his attorney before he came back and decided to plead guilty, that he understood on the charges that he faced, the two robberies and a firearm charge, that he faced 5 to life on those charges, on those two robberies, each of those two robberies, and that he faced an additional term of years on the firearm conviction. So the trial court simply was entitled to rely on the colloquy, as it did, in determining that the defendant had, in fact, entered a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. We can stop there, or we can go on and review the court's alternative finding that the defendant did not establish any of the grounds that he was required to establish in order to support his motion to allow him to withdraw the guilty plea. There was no showing of good faith. We submit that the court's finding of good faith was a finding of fact that's based on this court's decision in Ramsey and this court's decision in Pritchett. Again, there's no finding of good faith based on the plea agreement itself, as well as the defendant's statements during the plea colloquy. We submit that the trial court found that there was no reasonable defense proffered by the defendant. If you look at the evidence in this case, this defense, what he did proffer was basically a challenge to the victim, and that would have been Gaines's preliminary hearing testimony. And we submit that this court's decisions, again, in Ramsey and in another case, Williams, indicate that a defense based on the credibility of the victim's testimony is simply not enough to demonstrate a reasonable defense. As the Commonwealth pointed out, even if you accept the evidence, the testimony that was put on by the defendant at the motion to withdraw, if you accept that testimony, it still points to the defendant as being a principal in the second degree. He was the person who arranged the drug purchase, the marijuana purchase. He was the one who knew Johnson, the victim that was killed in this case. His girlfriend drove the defendant and Clinton to Johnson's location where Johnson and Gaines were located. And it was at his direction that the girlfriend makes this drive. They stop along the way and pick up the duct tape. The girlfriend testifies that the defendant is in an argument with Johnson, who's ultimately killed, about the trash bag of marijuana being light in weight. And certainly he's present when both victims are shot and one is killed. So at the very least, he's a principal in the second degree. So he's failed at that prong. And then finally, we have the court's finding of prejudice to the Commonwealth. And as other counsel has submitted, that's a factual finding. That's not to be disturbed on appeal unless plainly wrong. And the court indicated that the Commonwealth's witnesses had already been sentenced. That was at page 202 and 270 of the appendix record.
What's implicit with that, Ms. Darren?
Implicit with that finding is that the Commonwealth had nothing at that point to hold over the head of any of the witnesses to testify, as they had indicated. So, again, we submit that the defendant had the burden to meet all three of those prongs, and he hasn't met one. So, for these reasons, based on the waiver, as well as the findings by the trial court with regard to the defendant's failure to meet his burden, we submit there was no abuse of discretion in this case, and we ask that the court affirm the convictions. Thank you.
Mr. Barbara?
Thank you. Focusing on admissions made by a defendant in a guilty plea and the attendant colloquy is misplaced in the context of a Code Section 19.2296 motion to withdraw a guilty plea prior to sentencing. And so, I mean, all of this, everything...
That relates, though, to guilty pleas, not to guilty plea agreements.
Well, it does, but the guilty plea is, I mean, that same colloquy, the court's not... I don't know how the court can say on the one hand... You can't focus on that colloquy for purposes of a 296 motion, but we can completely rely upon it in order to uphold the validity of an underlying plea agreement that's going to foreclose you from a 296. It just seems like it's almost a catch-21 there, that you either can focus on it or not focus on it. I will say this about the case that upheld the case of Griffin that was cited here a few moments ago. And the one thing I've seen about Griffin, and I'm not aware of any, I don't know if that's the only case, that's the only case I'm aware of that talks about the explicit waiver, but Griffin, there was a waiver that was wrapped around the prejudice problem. And the waiver even stated that, you know, we're waiving this right to withdraw because it will prejudice the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth was ready to go forward. You know, that was all put on the record. The trial court was going to hold off on sentencing, but it You know, so there's a direct connection there, and it was even in the waiver about a prejudice component. And the court didn't just stop at looking at the waiver itself. It went on and analyzed that prejudice component, too. So I think there is some distinction between Griffin and the current case, present case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down and greet counsel and then...